So this is the title that is for what has just been accepted by PRL. And I haven't changed the title on my talk, which is what is on, which is on the archive. See, zoom.
Slideshow, bottom of the view.
Thank you. Now I have to do this. Oh God. Escape. Get rid of that. No. No. Oh God. There, finally went.
Excellent.
Quit. Now I can do slideshow. Come on there. Okay, fine. So I'm going to be talking about the interaction of two anti-parallel quantum vortices. Many of you have probably heard me say over and over again what happens when two classical anti-parallel vortices interact. And so I was inspired in this August of 2009 by a speaker at a meeting in Ithaca, New York, who was saying that quantum vortices don't stretch. In fact, that speaker had even written in a review where he stated that fact. And I said, quantum vortices, you believe that law of Biot sub R controls them at some level. Biot sub R acting on vortices stretches vortices. How can you say that quantum vortices don't stretch? He said, well, it's accepted. So part of this talk will be going back to a little bit of the history about where that mythology came from. Anyway, so here's two anti-parallel vortices. That's Euler. You have to imagine a lot of what I'm going to be showing is half of one of these vortices. Thanks to a student at Maryland, I've got some better graphics. That is what I've been spending the last time adding to the talk. But if you take half of one of these vortices, it starts out looking like this. Then where the perturbation is largest on the vortex, it goes to this symmetry plane here. There's a mirror image of the vortex on the other side. That's roughly the stage here. You see these two vortices. They've been propagating along, and what happens is where the perturbation is the largest, they propagate faster. In an incompressible flow, if they're pulled out one way and stretched one way, there has to be compression the other way, and in an incompressible flow, that pushes them together. Of course, quantum fluids aren't incompressible, but nonetheless, sort of the same thing happens. You get them pushed together. And then what happens in the quantum case is you get a vacuum forming on the symmetry plane, and you get reconnection, and the reconnection leads to a bunch of vortex rings. So that's the whole talk in 30
are these
seconds.
Cartoons or the result of
these are the results of a low resolution calculation. So there's something between a cartoon and what I'm going to be talking about. So the punchline is I'm going to say that anti-parallel quantum vortex reconnection suggests how to generate the depletion of kinetic energy by the creation of interaction energy during vortex stretching. So in a quantum system, it's a Hamiltonian system, energy must be conserved. But as you learned this morning, there are two parts to the Hamiltonian. So you can take energy out of the kinetic energy and you can put it in another component. And what's observed, in my opinion, and the results I'm going to show, is what's observed is the decay of kinetic energy. There's a lot of talk about the fact that this apparent decay of kinetic energy is due to waves on vortex lines. Okay, I'm going to show you waves on vortex lines. However, these are due to non-local oscillations between the vortices. They are not due to the local induction approximation. They are not the weak turbulence waves that other people emphasize. They are not the 1D Kelvin waves from the local induction approximation. What I see instead, as you just saw, is I get these disconnected vortex rings. And you could say, well, they take energy out of the system by propagating out of the system. An equally valid interpretation of my numerical results could be that the rings evaporate into 3D phonons, 3D Kelvin waves. And that could be the effective dissipation mechanism. I get a minus 5/30 vector. The mechanism for these events is that it seems that what could be called the kinetic energy, or I prefer to call it the gradient energy, cascades to small scales. It is converted to interaction energy at the small scale, and then that seems to cascade to large scales. But the analysis for saying this line really hasn't happened yet. This is just sort of a hand wave at this point. The Unkar is to find similar effects in classical fluids. So not all, but many of the same things seem to happen in my latest calculations of classical vortex reconnection. Differences are many. Similarities are proving more difficult to show. Much more resolution is needed for the classical case. A new initial condition is needed before I can do it right. But if I can demonstrate that parts of this scenario convert over to the classical case, then these events could form the building blocks for all classical turbulence, that you get the transition from laminar flow or smooth flow to turbulence. It'll happen with minimal viscosity, and out of it you would get finite energy dissipation of minus 5/30 spectrum. That's where I would like to go. Not there yet. Okay, so it was requested that I give sort of background on what quantum turbulence is, at least the quantum turbulence that we now see. So we go back to 1937, 1938 in Moscow, in Kapitsa's lab, where superfluidity was discovered. So here's Kapitsa. So he used the apparatus that he originally developed at Cambridge. He had his passport confiscated by Stalin when he went back to Moscow, and Rutherford allowed his Cambridge equipment to be sent to Moscow, which led to the discoveries of superfluidity. Now, roughly at that time, a Georgian in his lab in Moscow, Andron Chikashvili, and one of the Russians, who isn't even Georgian, can pronounce that better than me. But this is, you put a pile into the superfluid and you rotate it, and you discover that there are actually two parts to the superfluid. There's a normal fluid component that seems to behave like a classical fluid. And at the transition to the superfluid stage, about 2.3 degrees Kelvin, it's all normal fluid. But as the temperature drops, the normal fluid component drops, the superfluid component increases. So this is Landau's theory, eventually. But this was the first indication of this. Now, this set of experiments done at this time was also the first indication that there was something called quantum turbulence. Because one of the properties of the superfluid is you put a sieve in the superfluid in some way, you let the superfluid drain through the sieve, and it drains as if it's a fluid without viscosity. In analogy to a superconductor, is a flow of current through a metal without viscosity.
Resistance.
Without resistance. Thank you. And they discovered very quickly that if the flow velocity was over a certain amount, that suddenly the quantum fluid, in some sense, behaved like a classical fluid with, as if it had a viscosity. So this was just a mystery for a long time. Now, in the 1950s, these two men here, Henry Hall and Joe Vinon, did a number of experiments in rotating vats. So you rotate it around, you assume you rotate it enough, you get a bunch of these quantum vortices that are nucleated in the quantum fluid. And then the question is, if you then stop rotating it, how quickly does it decay? Does the rotating state decay away? There's a certain decay law that was gotten. And they propose that what happens is something called mutual friction, that is that there is no normal component, there's a quantum component of this. There are quantum vortices, there are probably also classical vortices. If these equilibrate along vortex cores, then you would expect a transfer of energy from the superfluid vortices, from the quantum vortices to the normal fluid vortices. Normal fluid has a viscosity, therefore your problem is solved.
Long Dao was saying that there is the mutual friction, and it was proportional to the vorticity.
There was some theory behind this, yes. I mean, Landau certainly contributed to this. I mean, it was Ansager, Feynman, Landau who were debating whether it was quantum vortices or quantum vortex sheets. A lot of history there that I'm not all that aware of. Maybe Dan can fill in.
No, I was just going to comment that Joe Vine and I know smilier than that, I have to say.
No.
That looks like a very bad news Joe Vine day.
This is what's on the University of Birmingham. No, actually, it's on the Royal Society webpage.
No. It's a
gloomy,
right?
I'll look for a better picture for it. Now, of course, you have to realize we all call him Joe. I mean, maybe there's someone here who knows why he's called Joe, but his name is William F. And he sent an email, it has to go to wfbyman@birmingham.ac.uk.
It's a childhood nickname, so I understand it.
Okay, fine. I think this was the first time second sound was used. That's an oscillation between normal fluid and superfluid that can be used to probe vortices. This was very important for the higher temperature superfluids. It stops working at a certain point. Anyway, so they sort of established the idea of mutual friction, for better or worse. Now, we go back to Chicago. In the mid-1960s. Now, I'm from the south side of Chicago, so I was actually around when these experiments were being done.
In high school?
No, I wasn't that old. I'm not that old. Anyway, there's Russ. He sent me this picture, and he didn't put the tailor on there. And I was trying to think, what professor of mine was Jeffrey Ingram? I couldn't remember Jeffrey Ingram at the University of Chicago when I went there about 10 years later. And I don't remember who Dave Foltz is. In any case, the idea is that you use ions. Okay, so you have a source of ions, you have electrodes, the ions you send through the superfluid. It's rotating. So you've got a bunch of superfluid vortices through the middle of this. Now, the trick is that we believe that each ion has a vortex ring attached to it. And you can modify the size and speed of the vortex rings by modifying the potential across these probes, across the electrodes. Now, part of the reason I'm making such a point of this is that second sound and other means of dealing with vortices in superfluids basically stop working once there is no normal fluid. You need ions for two purposes. You need ions to generate vortices, vortex rings, and you need ions to probe the density of vortex rings. And this is very critical for the experiment that really got me tuned into this by Golub and Walmsley up in Manchester, which is fairly recent. Anyway, the whole idea of this was developed by Russ and Klaus Schwarz in the mid-1960s. So that's one picture. So the idea is if there's more voltage, then the rings have more energy, but they're bigger. That means they go slower. And the whole idea is that if you have a small vortex that's going fast through the thing, it maybe probably won't hit a vortex line. On the other hand, a big fat one going through a bunch of vortex lines, it's certainly going to hit something and get scattered off. And they had this plot of the voltage versus the scattering. So the more voltage, the bigger the rings, the more the scattering. And so the way I look upon this, I mean, someone with some more sense of history, is that this experiment really established the possibility that quantum vortices are distinct, can be formed, and are distinct from those that form from rotation. So you have the quantum vortices from rotation, but you can have quantum vortex rings or other types of vortices going around as well. And basically, there's no interaction unless the vortex rings hit the central vortex. And what happened after that was that Clauss decided that the way to explain this was to use something called the local induction approximation. He says if a vortex line doesn't interact with another until it hits it, then we should use the most local version of the possible interactions along vortex lines. It was very popular in the aeronautics business at that time, Hummus and Arms, Physics of Fluids, 1962 or something, that this local induction approximation was running around. And Clauss decided to adopt it for quantum fluids and wrote a lot of papers on it. And it's basically because Klaus Schwarz said, gee, this is how to do things for 10 years, or more than that, more like 15 years, that this became ingrained in everyone's psyche as this is the proper way to look at vortices in quantum fluids. But it all goes back to this experiment, a very beautifully done experiment, but a very bad interpretation of the experiment in the end.
It's just the first approximation.
Yes, right. Okay, now, is Nigel here?
No.
Okay.
So you can say what you really think about it.
I'd like to hear what he has to say about it. Because I never can get any answers out of either Donnelly or Biden. The only person who's ever explained this experiment to me is Klaus Schwarz. Now, other than Gunter, I don't know if there's anyone here who, maybe Dan, who's crossed paths with Klaus, especially in the mid-1990s. He wasn't the easiest person to get along with then. Any case, in this experiment, there were two experiments. There was counterflow, and there was classical decay behind a grid. I've never quite figured out which curve is which, but the point is, from this, that if you take the vortex line length, the density, which is found in this case by scattering of second sound, and you put a power law on it.
How you measure this length?
So you have second sound emitted here by just temperature fluctuations observed over here.
Okay.
And you just look at the scattering of the second sound through the tangle of vortex lines.
Okay.
And there's an empirical sort of...
It's a side of a tangle, not of a given line, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing is the density of vortex lines that get scattered.
Okay.
Okay. And that, and you turn that into vortex line lines.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And it decays as t to the minus m. And this showed that m was approximately 1.5.
So it shrinks.
The density of vortex lines is decreasing. With
density decreases, then distance must increase.
The intervortex line spacing increases. The intervortex line spacing is roughly the same as the Kolmogorov
quantity.
This is L. This is the length over all time of space of the vortex lines. That's what that is.
And why it decreases?
Why does it decrease? Well, that's what we'll get to.
No, but they force it, they stop forcing it, and then they watch it decay. So they're no longer forcing the turbulence, and so the line length decays by whatever dissipative processes the helium can
also. So the amplitude of vorticity decays, but why the scale decays?
This is not the scale, this is the length of vortex.
Ah, this is the scattering scale, which is a measure of vorticity inside.
It's the length of
and
vortex.
Like, this is like the line square vortex. Root of the entropy. Okay?
Well, and that's the entropy has dimensionality 1 second.
There's problems with dimensionality, okay. I'm just giving a back of the envelope argument right here. If you say that the length is this and you have the circulation around each vortex line
Is
fixed.
Okay.
Okay, now you understand.
Omega T minus 3 is this, I can understand.
Okay, fine. So
if it's equivalent.
It's equivalent to omega T minus 3. Okay? Which corresponds to classical energy decay of T to the minus 2. Okay? And there's only one way to get this in a classical fluid, is you do a numerical simulation with periodic boundary conditions. You put the energy spectrum with the peak at the size of the box, and you let it go. Okay? And you see this decay rate corresponding to that. Okay? This was first found by Stu Patterson, who was the director of scientific computing at NCAR in the late 1970s. Stu never published anything. He said, while I was getting my PhD at NCAR, why don't you look for this? So the first place this was actually published is in my PhD thesis, which is why I wanted to have my Cornell thesis referenced properly. Okay, so the fact that I had sort of gotten something, this I got my attention. Now, Krause's take on this was that obviously these guys didn't know what they were doing experimentally, and these guys had made a mistake, because he knew that mutual friction couldn't give that type of strong decay, because it takes time for the superfluid vortex cores and the normal fluid vortex cores to equilibrate to the point where the mutual friction would take hold. And in these counterflow experiments, there wasn't enough time. He'd done these estimates. There just wasn't enough time.
But then in a normal fluid, you get it only if you have already not spreading, which means that this already have a size of the box.
Yes.
You need to stop spreading, and then the decay follows this
way. Yes, exactly.
Otherwise, that would be different.
Correct. Okay, right. Okay, so that was his argument why mutual friction couldn't be the case. So he said they obviously had a mistake with their experiment, which had more to do with causes than it had to do with the experiment or the people doing the experiment. Okay, so said that. Now, why did I get interested in superfluids at all? When I was at Chicago, I went and asked if I could take the fluid dynamics course that was in the course module, the course book, and they said, "Oh, the guy who did that just left." And this was 1972 or 3, just in the definition of the University of Chicago meant that Russ Donnelly had left in 1966. Not exactly just in my, but he said, take the statistical physics course that's being taught by his ex-student, Paul Schwartz. So anyway, getting done with my undergraduate, I'm saying, I don't want to stay in Chicago. Where do I go to graduate school? And they say, go to Cornell. Okay, and the reason you want to go to Cornell is that they have just discovered the superfluid state of helium-3. So these are the 1, 2, 3 people responsible for this. This is the diagram in PRL that got them a Nobel Prize. The other thing that I was told was that there's been this great thing done with the Nouri normalization group. Yes, right. Nigel mentioned Ben Whittam going on to Fisher and Wilson yesterday. So I actually started my PhD with this guy, and he's collaborating with Dan back there. And through that, I'm collaborating with Michael Fisher again. So some of the pictures here are through these various connections towards the end of this talk. So anyway, I went to Cornell, played around with the Nouri normalization group, and then went into classical fluids. Okay. So, what equations are we talking about? So, my version of the Gross-Pitiyowski equations, the ones that I integrate, are these. So you got a summary on generalized nonlinear Schrodinger equations this morning. From
you have Mustor. You have Mustor for Jim. Yeah.
I prefer writing the nonlinear this way because I think about a background constant density of one fluid with things going on around that, and then this squared makes, when you get to the interaction energy, it makes sense. This contains the kinetic energy. This is the one that I actually do the analysis on. It's much easier. I can show you privately afterwards what I can do spectrally with the combination of these things. That's why I integrate. But when I'm talking to classical fluids people, and for the classical fluids people here, I've done a lot of calculations on the Euler equations. That's Navier-Stokes without viscosity. Now, when I integrate those, I integrate the vorticity equation. And the important term that all the mathematics is about and all the controversy about is the vortex stretching. And I'm mentioning that because you can transform the Gross-Pitiyowski equations by the Madelung transformation into a combination of a ideal velocity equation with a very strange quantum pressure term, the sigma at the n, and a very standard mass density equation. So that's a way to look upon this from the classical point of view. So this is the interaction of two antiparallel vortices in Euler. half of one of these vortices. This comes up and twists around. Now, this twist, I think, is important, but it's probably going to be not discussed today. When I do the initial condition, this is half of one of the vortices, I get the approach. I showed you a picture of this already, but there's this twist here and a twist here, and these twists are going to be very important in the quantum case. And I'm saying that whatever dynamics, which is Biot sub R, that's leading to these two things here, is probably similar, but that's the topic of a subsequent paper. I've got a vortex model that explains that, I claim, or will claim. Okay, so Gross-Kodiakovsky equation, cubic nonlinearity. I prefer a factor of a half there for reasons I might get to. We conserve mass, that's what I consider it to be, mass, not particle number. Conserves the Hamiltonian, also conserves the momentum things that we should talk about. I use a background density of absolute value psi squared equal 1. I use for boundary conditions sort of the quantum equivalent of free slip boundary conditions in all directions. There are two reasons for that. I can impose symmetries very easily. And the other reason is that a good first approximation to the walls of a superfluid vat is Neumann, not no slip, not prime.
It's
not
periodic. It's just the box.
Yeah, not periodic. But you can imagine this as part of a periodic box. Okay, I have a bunch of cubes that I've put together in a Rubik's type situation, 8 cubes in one box, and that's periodic.
This is ratio, yeah.
Okay, other people have to put in symmetric vortices to deal with this problem. I get around it by using this.
Excuse me?
Yes.
May I ask, the background density is psi squared? What is the background density, and then what is your field describing? I'm not sure if I understand that you introduce a background density.
For Bose-Einstein condensate, that's inappropriate. But for a quantum fluid that is a helium in the vat, the density is pretty much constant throughout. The only place where the density is either less than or greater than the background is either the vortex cores or any waves that are running around.
Yeah, but so your initial condition is a density, like the initial condition of your field is a vortex line, which has density zero in the center?
Yes.
So.
But outside of the vortex lines, the density is one.
Yes.
This is the normalized ground state.
It's a, right, normalized ground state. This is not what you would do for Bose-Einstein condensing. Not at all.
Okay, but you don't have two fields, like one background which simulates the normal fluid and then one.
No, I'm doing one set of equations.
Okay.
Yeah. To do the normal fluid, really, you have to do Hartree-Fock. And there are people doing this, coupling to Gross-Kodiakovsky. That's not what I'm doing.
Well, there are several papers claiming that just the waves that run around act like a normal fluid. You don't need any other equations.
Yeah, I know about that. I'm not going to get into that. Okay, they've been claiming the same thing for Navier-Stokes too, same people. Okay, I'm not going to get into that. Not here, not online. this is the Madelon transformation. The reason for my factors of half. When I do the factors of half, then the phase velocity is just the gradient of the phase. I don't have to have an extra factor of half there. There's two parts to the pressure. There's the barotropic part, and then there's this weird quantum part. And somebody said, well, why don't you simulate this way? And I said, no, this is not the way you simulate these equations. You simulate the three-dimensional Gross-Kodiakovsky equations. Okay. Fluid is irrotational, except at these infinitely thin defects called vortex quantum vortices. The way you understand these is that you have the wave function, square root of the density, times e to the I phi. So if you have phi go around 2 pi, around one of these defects, then you can say that there's a quantum circulation, which will be some gamma, 2 pi rho naught, around each of these defects. Now, I'm using gamma for circulation. The quantum fluid people prefer to use kappa. But I want to use kappa for the curvature of vortex lines when I get to that, which is going to be in this talk. So gamma is my circulation.
Oh, so it's not just 2 pi? I don't know why the row knot's there.
I don't know if
it has to have density. I mean, real circulation has units of density. Okay. I mean, I might have something wrong here, and if I, you know, if
it's okay.
But you're not as unity anyway.
Yeah, it's unity anyway, right?
That's fine.
Okay. Okay, let's see. So classical fluid, as opposed to this, so this is vorticity only on these infinitely thin defects. In classical fluid, vorticity is distributed uniformly. And for an ideal classical fluid Euler equations, values of the circulation are constant along Lagrangian trajectories. This is something that's very important in my latest analysis of the Euler equations, another topic. With viscosity in the Navier-Stokes equation, vortices can reconnect. There's a topological change in the circulation. And in Navier-Stokes equation, circulation does not follow Lagrangian trajectories. Okay. There will be an analogy in a quantum fluid for the effect of viscosity in the sense that I will show you reconnection. There will be topological change of the circulation. And that's the extent to which it behaves. So there can be reconnection in the quantum case without viscosity, but there can be reconnection without topological changes in the circulation.
So in quantum case, you don't need to add anything to nonlinear Schrödinger equation, to Gross-Potayevsky. Just within Gross-Potayevsky, you have reconnection.
Right, exactly. So the total Hamiltonian, as I said, you can divide it into all sorts of different components, but the total shouldn't decay in time. But energy can be transferred between components, which is what I'm going to get to. Similarities is that I can write a fluid-like equation for the quantum case. There's circulation, there's energy transfer between scales, and there's reconnection for both classical and quantum. Now, I got really interested in this when there was a physics colloquium at Warwick given by Dieter Volhard from Augsburg, and the topic of his colloquium, it wasn't his work, were recent advances in quantum turbulence. So I knew about this Vinen-Smith, Goldenfeld, Donnelly-Vinen experiment, and I knew the explanation that this was mutual friction, but he said, and I don't know why, but that this experiment in Helsinki demonstrated decay of quantum turbulence at ultra-low temperatures, which is what you have to have in helium-3 if it's superfluid, without any normal fluid. Now, I can't understand this experiment, but I can understand he presented the, at that point, unpublished work by Walmsley and Golov. And the point they have, so they're now at not helium-3, but helium-4, at 0.15 degrees Kelvin, cold enough that there's virtually no normal fluid. They have to generate the turbulence by putting strong beams of ions in one direction, and then that turns off, and then they have a weak beam of ions in the other direction, which is the scatterers, and that's how they measure the density of vortex lines. There's obviously transients that happen depending on how they initialize it, but the whole point of their experiment is that invariably, independent of whatever the transients are, they get a decay of the vortex line length that is again t to the minus 3/2. So this is a decay t to the minus 3/2 that's independent of any normal fluid, no mutual friction. And I said to myself, okay, fine, this has to be a property of the Gross-Potayevsky equations. So that, now it took a while before I got inspired about what to do about that in the right way. I played around with vortex models, mainly from the point of view trying to find analogies between Euler and quantum fluids for about a year. and I still have that paper on the back burner. But then, as I say, there was this meeting in Ithaca in August of 2009. I was really hoping that I would actually talk to somebody. And Everhart and me wandered around the basement of Clark Hall for about an hour. We found Eric Smith, nobody else. We talked for, what, 2 minutes to David Lee? Right. But he wasn't interested in this stuff anymore. So anyway, there was some interest at the meeting. I was on the flight home to the UK, and I decided I'm going to spend the rest of my summer vacation figuring out I'm going to change my code. Yes?
Sorry, I didn't want to stop.
Change my code to a gross Pediaski code, since I had basically everything in place for doing this, except I just had to change the equations from Euler to nonlinear Schrodinger, and so I went ahead and did it.
So my question was, for L to go as t to the minus 3/2, there has to be something to mediate the fact they're dimensionally inconsistent. Is there an understanding of what that is?
So I just said to Grisha before, the circulation is what converts this into something equivalent to entropy.
Okay, so I just did the pi theorem on L and T, and if you only use the circulation, it has to go as T inverse, not T to the minus 3/2. if the quantum circulation is the only dimensionally relevant parameter, it can't go as T to the minus 3/2.
No, it's squared. Okay, you take L squared.
L is centimeters to the minus 2, like you have up there.
You get gamma, which is a length squared over time.
Right.
Okay.
Agreed.
And what you have to do is get 2t squared.
Circulation is always centimeter squared, so that is right. I mean, you. If you want to cancel centimeter squared, the circulation cancels in the first power, because some circulation is centimeter squared per second.
And it's got to be t inverse.
And then you need to cancel second, and then it would be 1 over t, which tells you that there is something else here.
Well, it's not a complicated game, but it can't just be the
gamma squared. Okay, this is the density. L is actually what you have to do is it's
if you just say
what he calls L is L over V. Okay, that gives you dimensions of centimeters minus 2. So this is the vortex line length. This is the volume.
Understood.
Okay.
Entirely.
Okay. So then you have gamma squared, L squared, and you have dimensions of what they're calling L. You have length squared over time squared, which is entropy. This is what we have to do numerically to get this. Okay, because I'll get to that in a second. Okay, so where do I go from here? This is pictures of what quantum turbulence might look like. Okay, now this is the initial condition that I am now starting with. A very, very long pair of vortices, much longer than I ever used for the classical case, for reasons that you'll see shortly. Perturbation here of the two vortices. That's the only thing. Now, when I do these calculations, of course, there's a symmetry between the vortices. There's a symmetry across this point. I'm only doing 1/2 of one of these vortices. So some of the graphics, so this was put together by Chitili Rurai, who's working with Dan, Michael, and myself at Maryland right now. I'm going to show you some of my pictures that are still only half of one vortex in here. So now this is what happens. So you have, this is your initial condition. Here you see the vortices being approaching. You're seeing a lot of wiggles forming on the back sides of these things, coming off of that. And then the thing that happens is you get reconnection, and you get two vortex rings on either side. But you can see here incipient vortex rings happening all along here. And then what happens is you just get a whole cascade of these vortex rings. So the reason why that this is so long is that my initial calculation in this direction was cut off around here. And the trouble was is that the vortex rings immediately hit the wall and started bouncing back, and therefore I couldn't tell what was going on with the energy decay. This way I have a chance of doing that.
Can you do just one vortex? The same study with one vortex?
Excuse me?
Could you do the same simulation with just one vortex?
No, because you have to have the Biot-Savart interaction. All this stuff about a single vortex and waves on vortices just doesn't
have... Just waves running on the vortex.
Yeah.
Well, it won't
reconnect.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
You can get this stuff. The whole thing...
The propagation,
I mean,
the perturbation.
There is this paper by Nazarenko and Lavov, which, despite what they say, says the truth at some point, which is our wave turbulence model can't explain the decay rate that's observed experimentally. Therefore, they say, well, we've got to do this, this, and the other thing. But you don't need to do that here. Get reconnection, get vortex rings. You've got a strong mechanism for getting energy out of the system, and that seems to be what's happening.
How do you prepare the initial condition?
That was a chore. I essentially put a line in space, and then I put a ring around that line, and I have a profile for the density as it goes into the line that's in my 3D space. I just use a classical 2D solution for that profile. To do that without thinking generates problems, very technical problems, which I'm still...
Generates a large amount of sound.
I avoid that problem by filtering at high wave numbers in Fourier space. But it does develop some inconsistencies along those lines. The first time I did this, and it actually told me what I'd been doing wrong and everybody else had been doing wrong for the last 25 years for Euler. That's why I have to do a new initial condition for Euler, but that's another topic. Okay, so here's a blow-up of the inner close-in region. So here's this pushing together. Here's it breaking apart into these rings. I'm going to skip a couple of these pictures here. So here's my two vortices. Here's half of one of these vortices at t equals 1.5. So this is the time that I was showing you where there's that first reconnection. And the reconnection happens across this y. Let's see, this is x. No, I've got my directions wrong. This is x. This xz symmetry plane, it happens because this is an isosurface of density. If I'm doing Euler, it's isosurfaces of vorticity. This is isosurfaces of density, very low density. Vortex stretching initially causes these twists, which are very similar to what I get in Euler. But then what happens that doesn't happen in Euler is the vortex stretching causes a vacuum to form between the vortices. I mean, stretching, you're not just pulling out the vortex lines, you're removing fluid. So you get this big region of low density between the vortices. So that solves the problem of reconnection and topological change without viscosity, because what happens is that the topological change occurs where the density is zero. Okay, now my original set of pictures, which I am going to be replacing with things like this in the new version of PRL, is that we're showing you this way, which is what MATLAB automatically gave me without thinking. That gives a different perspective on the twist here, and at later times it gives a perspective on this feature back here. So this is the next time. This is the time at which there's a single vortex here in the full domain. There's another one on this side. But you see there's a whole bunch of waves along this vortex. And all of these waves are generated by this torsion at this point here. And this shows up in my vortex model as well. And it shows up in Euler. So you don't get just one vortex ring. You get, and one reconnection, you get a whole series of these. Now, one of the things that I find amazing, which can explain some classical results, is that the vortex stretching does not end at this point. So there's this enormous stretching which is pulling these out, creates the reconnection event. The stretching continues until the second reconnection event happens. And this can explain some results of Daryl Holman mine in classical fluids. Okay, so.
What do you mean by vortex stretching?
I'll get to that. Okay, then the next stage is that this accordion-like shape, these waves, breaks up into a lot of individual vortices. They're smaller as you go out, so they don't run into each other, and it just goes out of the system. And when I say out of the system, I mean just out of the inner region where my interaction started. That's what I mean. Okay, so what makes a turbulent a flow turbulent? Okay, you want an energy cascade, perhaps. You want a minus 5/3 spectrum, hopefully. Energy decay. Of course, we have to define energy first. So as I said, I've got a Hamiltonian. I'm going to call this gradient energy. This component here, there's the interaction energy, which is 1 minus rho squared, 1 minus the modulus of the wave function squared. I have a formula for showing the exchange between these two components in Fourier space. That's another thing you can ask me about afterwards. Some people like to just break up the gradient energy into different components in this way. I'm not going to try and do that, not now at least. And how could there be effective energy decay? There can be effective energy decay if there's depletion of this gradient slash kinetic energy and conversion of that into interaction energy. Okay. So what do the experiments measure when they measure decay? So what they're seeing is the scattering of the ions or second sound off the regions of near vacuum. Okay, so this is a volume of rho almost zero. A number of assumptions are made to relate this to kinetic energy. These are the arguments for doing this, which I've sort of outlined before. The important thing here is that I need an equal sign here. If L, this quantity, which is the volume divided by the area, integral of dSL t to the minus 3/2, and you square that, you get an effective entropy Z, which is dS L squared that should go as t to the minus 3. Okay. So how is this observed? How is it explained? Okay. So Feynman sort of made a suggestion. There's some pictures in a paper of his, 1955 or so. Quantum vortex lines could reconnect to form vortex rings that could then propagate out of the system. Or you have some mechanism for creating linear waves, bonons. And sort of the suggestion of Paul Roberts was that you do get vortex rings, but they break down into rarefaction waves and then into phonons, and they propagate out of the system. Now, there's been a lot of talk about waves on vortices, and there's been proposals for that.
You mentioned previously that there is no 1D Kelvin waves. And what are the linear waves in?
I'm talking about 3D waves in the Gross-Piediowski equations.
Yes, phonons.
Phonons. Okay, phonons is what I mean. Okay, so people proposed waves on vortices. So what I'm going to propose is vortex stretching, the conversion of the kinetic energy into the interaction energy. All these wave turbulence things assume the local induction approximation. Another talk is why did Clouts suggest this? What's wrong with it in terms of simulations that me and other people have done? And I don't want to get into that. So that's that. Okay, so this is my plots. So first is global interaction energy E sub I, which is the red dots. Blue is the gradient energy, and L is the vortex line length, which I determined by counting boxes, how many boxes where the density is very, very small, and divide that by the classical area of a 2D steady state vortex in Gross-Piebiaski. So that's what L is. So initially L, there's some adjustment in the initial condition, and then L grows. So you ask me, what do I mean by vortex stretching? What I mean by is that this measure of the vortex line length grows. Now this is seen, this measure that I'm using has been used by Berenghi's group in Newcastle in England, and they report similar results for initial growth of vortex line length in their calculations. Now, during this phase, the kinetic energy, blue, decreases, and that energy is turned into interaction energy. Now, interaction energy is deviations from the background density. So if you have a vortex core that's got more and more zero density in it, then the interaction energy will grow. So up to this time, about 10, things are okay. Then the vortex line length starts to decay. I starts to decrease, and so as the kinetic energy decreases, but globally what happens eventually is the gradient energy increases again, and the red line, the interaction energy, decreases. Now this is the point at which the vortex lines have hit the wall and are either reflecting back or doing something else. And the Taylor-Green calculations that Brachet's group in Paris have done, they've seen this oscillation from blue to red, but they had their own definition of vortex line length, and they did not associate any of this with what me and Berenghi, and I believe also Natalia Berloff, are calling the vortex line length. So this global measure sort of isn't showing what I wanted to show. So I went to the area just around where my initial interaction was, only part of the box. And if I do that, then I get my growth in the vortex line length, and it's decrease, but I get decay or depletion of kinetic energy all the way until I turn my calculation off. Okay? So this isn't good enough to get power laws out, etc., but it's a qualitative picture of where the observed decay of the vortex line length, which is all that's actually measured experimentally, how that could be related to the kinetic energy, and why it gives a decay, effective decay of kinetic energy, and where that energy is going. It's going one into the interaction energy, but in addition, you have all these vortex rings that are either propagating out of the system or they're breaking down into phonons. And that's where the kinetic energy is going. So that's some of my conclusions. Rings propagate out. I do a distribution. This is at a time equals 30. This is a distribution of density, about 1. And the point is, at this time, you have a distribution that is double peaked, about 1, which would be consistent with waves. So I'm saying that you could have the rings, but the rings could also be breaking down. And there's nothing inconsistent with my results with that explanation. And the last thing is if I look at the kinetic energy spectrum, so there's through most of this period the spectrum of the kinetic energy or the gradient energy and the interaction energy in Fourier space is k⁻³, but after the second reconnection,
so E is the global or
E is the interaction, and this is the gradient energy, and this one goes from about a -3 spectrum after the first couple of reconnections before things start bouncing back from the other wall, it gets about a decade or half a decade of k⁻⅝. Now, this isn't saying it's -5/3. The point is that there's a mechanism that's moving energy in large amounts to high wave numbers. There's a cascade mechanism going on.
How does the real kinetic energy scale? This is the gradient kinetic energy, right? What you got over there?
I haven't split it up. That's another topic. It's complicated. I have a student right now trying to sort through my notes on that. I've got some results if you want to see. Okay?
Excuse me? Do you have a part of the kinetic energy that's only due to sound waves?
I have not done that differentiation.
Yes, but I'm a little bit surprised that the kinetic energy is going to zero. You're saying that sound energy is transferred to the sound waves or the phones. I would expect to don't vanish. That quantity doesn't vanish.
You expect what now?
That this quantity, the kinetic energy...
This is the whole gradient energy. Okay, so it's everything together.
Yeah, you have two, one part is from the vortex and one part of the sound waves. And you showed in the picture before that this quantity is going to zero.
Which is going to zero?
For instance, the kinetic energy, the gradient.
Yes, right. Well, it's going to zero in that region, not globally. The top one's the global.
It radiates away. It's not the total energy is conserved.
Total energy is conserved.
Yes, kinetic energy also could not be zero, of course, it's just in this region. Okay. But the scattering experiments also.
So I just want to show as my last thing, this is classical, a new calculation that was done, which I haven't done the analysis on other than what you see. But the point is, I use a new profile for my classical vortices. I run it Navier-Stokes, so I get reconnection. I get the same. Flip up here as I got for the Gross-Pediavsky. And then what happens is it twists around to get a second reconnection. Here it's twisting around. If I do a cross section through the symmetry plane, you can see the vortex ring that's separated off. And what I'm saying is that in this type of reconnection, for the classical case, you also get a separation of vortices off, and that could very well explain properties in classical fluids. I've done a lot of calculations to check that I'm getting similar results for similar analysis on cases that other people have done, and I have some students looking at this case right now, and let me just put that up, and you can read that, and you had a question.
When you show only this y smaller than how much, what kind of length scale on this initial
vortex
thing? Does it make?
So, if this was my initial thing, this... that's the part that I'm... doing
so
the analysis.
It includes the whole kink and but a little bit more and so on.
Yeah, right. That's the idea. Okay.
Maybe we thank her to speak.